We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning, and welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. I'm David Inge. Today's first hour comes from the Focus 580 archives, so as you listen, do keep in mind, we'll not be taking your calls. Well, it is the case that since ancient times, scientists, philosophers, people of that sort, have had a lot to say about emotionality and madness in women. Our guest for this hour of Focus 580, historian Mark McCauley, says that this long line of male experts failed to see that men also suffered from nervous and mental illness, and it's only maybe within the last century or so that that's started to change. We'll talk this morning about the long suppression of male neuroses. That's the subject of Mark McCauley's book, Hysterical Men, The Hidden History of Male Mental Illness. And the book is published by the Harvard University Press out recently. So if you're interested in the book, you can go out and take a look at it. Our guest is Associate Professor of History and the History of Medicine here at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign. And this particular subject, that is how over time people have thought about mental illness, is a particular interest of his. And we're pleased that he could be here and talk about it with us. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
I appreciate it. In a very, very general way here, just we were chatting just a little bit before we got started, I said I thought that perhaps one of the things about the book that really interested me is that it takes a look at how it is over time I mean science, philosophy, psychology, and so forth, how these fields have thought about men and women, whether they're different, whether they're not, and mental illness. And it seems to be the case that for a long, long time, and maybe still today, there was a very pronounced gender had a very pronounced effect, or how we thought about gender had a very pronounced effect on how we thought about mental illness, what it was, and who had it.
Yes.
This particular focus on hysteria. Now, again, there's something that I think we need to start out with a definition, just because we have come to use this word rather casually
and at
various times, it has actually meant something much more specific, although also something kind of diffuse. So what when there was a medical condition called hysteria,
right?
What was that?
Mm. Well, that's probably the first point to get straight with this subject, is that we're not referring to hysteria in our own everyday popular sense today, when we might say, I don't know, I'm hysterical because I have so much work to do this weekend, or the voters on the streets of Tehran are behaving hysterically because of the election. It is hysteria as a formal medical diagnosis. And hysteria in the clinical sense does have a history that stretches back thousands of years. Part of the problem, though, in studying hysteria medically is that it's been defined in extremely different, varying ways. In fact, ways even that have been mutually exclusive over the centuries. Today, if the term is used by psychiatrists at all, it's probably in the Freudian sense of hysterical conversion. And by that, mental health workers mean a type of suffering, a collection of symptoms that are both physical and mental, but that trace ultimately to psychological and emotional distress and discomfort.
And while the notion of hysteria, as you say, is very long, this particular idea of hysteria, this way of thinking about it, is relatively young. Traces to, say, the late 19th century, really, when people like Freud and also there was a very famous French neurologist named Charcot who influenced Freud. They were the ones who – that was their take on hysteria.
It was. But at the same time, there have been many other earlier understandings and definitions of it. So for some physicians who were neurologists, they thought hysteria was the sign of a neurological disease, of a lesion in the nervous system. And then, of course, the longest type of explanations were gynecological theories of hysteria, which believed that the disorder was limited to the members of one sex, to women, and that it was a wide range of series, all of which tracked back to some disorder or dysfunction in the in women's reproductive physiology. Mm.
And that's indeed why we have the word, why it is called hysteria, which goes back to the Greek word for uterus.
Yes. In fact, the disease, the disorder, has a very colorful history, particularly its remote ancient history. Ancient Roman and Greek, and even before that, we think ancient Egyptian medics believed that hysteria was caused by the womb, which they interpreted – this is before doing a lot of anatomical postmortem studies – they believed the womb of the woman was was literally an independent, free-floating animal within the body cavity of women, and that if the womb was dissatisfied, which usually meant that the woman was unmarried and had not born children, that the womb in its dissatisfaction would begin rampaging through the body cavity of the woman and, among other things, put pressure on the other organs of the body cavity, causing difficulties breathing and a choking sensation, headaches, hiccups, and so forth. Mm-hmm. So obviously a very colorful, to us almost unimaginable, explanation, yeah. But one that right from the beginning reflects the degree to which this was seen as an all-female, intensely gendered type of pathology.
Yeah. At least, I suppose, one thing that you would say for them, at least they were saying that these kinds of symptoms had an organic explanation. It was a odd organic explanation, but at least we can give them the edge over, for example, people in the Middle Ages who tended to think that if people were mentally ill, it meant that they were possessed. At least the Greeks and the Egyptians were saying, well, something's going on in the body. Maybe we're not sure exactly what, but something is going on in the body.
Yes, that's right. For them, it was a disease of the body that had physical and mental manifestations, whereas today in our post-Freudian period, we would reverse the direction of causality there. We tend to think that in hysteria cases, in cases of most neuroses, there's an emotional psychological difficulty that's expressing itself through the language of the body. Mm-hmm. So I think scientifically speaking, one of the reasons I was drawn to this topic is centuries of theorizing this disorder are really right at the cusp of the famous mind-body boundary. What's the origins of the disorder and how does it cross that all-important mysterious border between mind and body?
Yeah. And apparently one of the things that makes it a little difficult to talk about, that is when you ask this question, well, what is – if you go back to the Greeks and say before we start to see the beginnings of modern science – why it is so difficult to get a handle on this, apparently they thought that a very wide range of symptoms could be the result of essentially the same thing. So that is, right. you could have a whole number of things that could all be symptoms of hysteria, and yet the symptoms could be really very different, all across the board.
Yes, I think at one point in the book I refer to hysteria as a synthesis of symptoms. And in fact, if you were to collect all of the symptoms that have been diagnosed as hysterical through the years, I mean, it's almost every imaginable symptom from, an itchy scalp to toe fungus. At first, I thought, well, how can this be? You know, this is so unrigorous and undiscriminating medically. But at some point, I began to realize that the very elasticity of the symptom picture was part of the appeal of the label. There was a late 19th century European physician who famously dubbed hysteria a wastebasket diagnosis. And I think what he meant by that was that if you've got a case that is presented to you in the doctor's office with a weird range of symptoms that don't otherwise cohere and make sense, and you can't track them to an ascertainable organic diagnosis, then you bring out the hysteria label and you slap that term on it, which allows the physician and the sufferer to think that they've got something. They have the satisfactions of a diagnosis, but in fact it doesn't really mean anything.
Yeah.
So through large parts of its history, it has been a very sloppy, clinically unrigorous label. I would put it that way, I think.
Yeah. Just another to reinforce the sort of one of the underlying ideas, though, that I think is really striking. It's that while some people would make the argument that we made some progress in terms of how we think about gender and men and women and what they're all about, that the idea that women are more fragile, more emotional, more prone to emotional difficulties that we have not completely eradicated. That's a very old, at least within Western thinking, that's a very old idea. We're talking about an idea that's been around for a couple of thousand years.
It is, yes. And I think that's what originally got me going with this project is I'm trained formally in the field of the histories of science and medicine. And in medical history, one of the best-known tropes of Western medicine is the idea of the female maladies, the belief that there's this cluster of disorders that women that are either exclusively women's diseases or that women are disproportionately prone to.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point, I just got to thinking, well, why is that? And why would diseases of the mind, why would psychopathologies in particular be so gendered, so associated with one sex rather than the other?
Yeah.
And then at some point, I did what historians are prone to do. I repaired to the library, to a very good medical historical collection in Washington, D.C. And in actually reading medical texts, the writings of physicians from the 18th and 19th century, I began to find dozens of published case histories in which hysteria as an official diagnosis was applied to male patients. So it was really this disconnect between our belief that hysteria and nervousness and the vapors are women's disorders, mm-hmm. that term in quotation, and what I was discovering in the archive, that in fact there was a kind of history, but as I say in my subtitle, a hidden history of male nervous illness out there, that caused me to take up this project and eventually write an entire book on it.
Yeah. And it seems that even once we get into the point where male, and obviously all the doctors and the researchers were males, where these people were starting to treat men with hysteria and with other kinds of emotional trauma. And so they had men who were patients. They were writing about this in their case histories and so forth. It seemed that there was still this effort to kind of downplay it as if to say, well, okay, yes, there are some men who have this, but let's not forget that primarily it's still, you know, if you look at the balance of their caseloads,
right,
and of the case studies that they left, they're not 50-50.
No, by no means. This is part of what I found fascinating. The story ended up being much, much more complicated than I believed. While I did discover dozens of cases that were so labeled in the past, the physicians who, as you rightly point out, at this time during the centuries I studied, were virtually all male.
Mm-hmm.
So by law, this is a male professional community. They tended time and again to have ways of sort of arguing away the significance and implication of widespread nervous disorders in the male population. So they would diagnose a case accurately, but say that it was so statistically rare as to be negligible. Or they would suggest, you know, sort of between the lines that this may be actually a misdiagnosed of some diagnosis of some safely organic disorder like, mm-hmm. Epilepsy or tuberculosis or syphilis. And then there was the interesting, troubling habit they had of acknowledging hysterical pathology in male patients, but only illustrating it with men who were from some stigmatized category, who maybe were from one of the European colonial countries, or from Jewish Eastern European men, or patients who were effeminate or homosexual, and so on and so forth. So I think that all of these, as I say, were sort of strategies of resistance. On the one hand, to acknowledge male nervous vulnerability, but on the other to still sort of distance the diagnostician, the male physician himself, from this female-tinged type of pathology.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that I certainly wonder, particularly going back to the ancient world, and perhaps you've already answered this, but specifically to look at the way that they thought about mental illness, surely there were examples of men who were suffering severe emotional distress. And I guess the thing that I think about, and I'm sure a lot of people think about, is emotional trauma as a result of battlefield experience. Certainly there must have been plenty of men who were experiencing, I don't know exactly what language, you know, we've called it a lot of things over the years,
who were
experiencing that, or other people because there was underlying organic issue that were manifesting symptoms of mental illness. What did they say about that? What did they say that was?
Right. Well, I think our own society's knowledge of, maybe even preoccupation with, so-called PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, is one of our contemporary contexts for looking at this subject. Certainly a very major reason why in the 20th century the reality of male neurosis has become much more widely accepted is because of this line of clinical inquiry about battlefield or war-related neurotic breakdown. Mm-hmm. The real departure in Western medicine was with World War I and the famous phenomenon of shell shock, rampant neurotic nervous breakdown in the trenches of northern France and Belgium because of the excruciating circumstances of living and fighting during the First World War. And as you say, the terminology for these war-related cases has changed in quite colorful ways over the generations. So it's been referred to as war neurasthenia, soldier's heart, shell shock. The history of the PTSD concept has been tracked from about the 1970s on. It enters American psychiatry officially in 1980. And, of course, as your listeners know, is flourishing today. Prior to World War I, though, in battlefield situations, there was a fairly widespread tendency to record and observe some of these breakdowns, but there just wasn't an official diagnosis for them yet. And there was a lot of mystery, of incomprehension about what they involved. I would probably add that there was a kind of unspoken conspiracy of silence, and you can see why. Soldiers are supposed to be the strongest and most manly members of our society. They engage in the archetypal masculine activity, which is fighting. They protect women and children. They defend the homeland. So if suddenly this very group that's supposed to be the most masculine is breaking down mm-hmm. in these sort of feminine, historically feminine ways, that would be problematic in all kinds of ways. So military medics, as well as I would say society at large, was invested for generations in not seeing neurosis in soldiers. That's really a 20th century idea and insight.
Yeah. I think it's also very striking that if you look at those periods where there was greater willingness to acknowledge male neurosis and less, mm-hmm. it seems that peacetime – people were perhaps a little bit more willing to accept the idea, but when nations were at war and it became much more important for men to embody, to be what it is we think we need it at wartime, which is warriors, much less willingness to even entertain the notion that there could be such a thing.
Very much so. This, again, was one of my discoveries in researching the projects, is that attitudes toward masculinity and femininity, and also toward the degree of perceived overlap between the two, really change over the years. And very often the change is related to larger historical events, none more important than war. So, for instance, in the 18th century, as you probably recall from a chapter in my book, it was generally regarded as acceptable, even flattering, to diagnose a male patient as having what was then called the nervous distempers. it was kind of seen as a sign of, you know, refinement or having a superior nervous system. But when the period of the French Revolution came along, followed by the Napoleonic experience, so these 1790s and the first 15 years of the 19th century, there was a retraction. Suddenly a sort of, I don't know, a remasculinization of a number of European countries. And there's a quite dramatic rupture in the medical discourses on hysteria during this period. It again becomes unacceptable and highly undesirable for men to suffer from nervousness during these war years. And I feel certain, you know, it's because, again, men during that period had to return to their traditional martial roles of being and projecting strength.
Yeah. Our guest this morning in this part of Focus 580, Mark McCauley, he is Associate Professor of History and the History of Medicine here at University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. We're talking about some of the ideas that you will find in his book, Hysterical Men, the subtitle, The Hidden History of Male Nervous Illness, and it's published by the Harvard University Press. We have a couple of callers here to bring into the conversation. Let's do that. They're in, first couple are in Urbana, so we'll start with line one right here. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I am so glad you're doing this. It's so important. I once worked with a mood disorder group, and you know what? They were all men, and no one even noticed that.
Mm-hmm.
And I've also observed that so much of male behavior that would be probably defined as abnormal if women did it, but it's below the radar for men. And I'm speaking of abusive behavior and what might be called, although I'm not really an authority on this, but I think it could be called the borderline personality.
Mm-hmm.
You hear so much about mood disorders and schizophrenia, but very little about borderline personality.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll hang up and listen, and thanks for your comment, and thanks so much for doing this.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm glad you I'm pleased you like the project. We certainly have today this idea that men continue to be less likely to seek out the care and the solace of a mental health professional than women are, and for reasons that are, I think, the same as the ones I document from the 18th and the 19th century, which is we still think of most men as less comfortable discussing feelings and emotions in their interior life and so forth. One of the questions this raises is the different behavior between men and women here just on the part of the sufferers or the patients who, as I say, are more or less likely to go to a psychologist or psychiatrist? Or is there also still some gendering in the act of diagnosis on the part of the physician or the psychologist, him or herself? There is a belief still that there are certain sort of sexist diagnostic practices in the mental health professions, or that certain disorders continue to be overdiagnosed perhaps in women and underdiagnosed in men. And then following up on that, I guess the third gloss I would add to your question is the possibility, you know, the real scientific possibility that men and women may, in the past and the present, express stress and distress in different ways, that there may be what one physician has called styles of psychological styles and styles of somatization. What we hear most often is the idea that women tend to internalize an emotional pain, hence the higher recorded or diagnosed rates of depressive disorders in women, whereas men are likelier to externalize them and to attempt to work through them through aggression or maybe, you know, a self-destructive lifestyle habit such as excessive drink and so forth. In many ways, the historical story I tell has changed, I think, but in other ways, not changed as much as we might think. So it's complicated and difficult teasing out all the ways in which preconceptions about what is a man, what is a woman, what constitutes masculinity and femininity continue to color psychiatric thought and practice, and to inform the way we think about ourselves and, our emotional selves, I would say.
All right. Let's talk with another caller, also in Urbana. This is, I believe, line number two. Hello.
Oh, hi. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Your term hysterica or hysterical, how it's defined historically, it sort of passes. Kind of reminds me of the term consumption. I used to say people got consumption or whatever, tuberculosis or whatever, cancer or whatever back historically. But I was going to ask you something. Have you ever thought about has anybody written about a historical consensus of the word, the psychiatric term or psychological term, normal? What is normal? I mean, historically, I'm sure it's changed, or socially it's changed. But there seems to be an idea that everybody carries around in their head what is normal behavior.
Right.
And but I also want to add that I was diagnosed with PTSD years ago from my combat experiences years ago. And I've seen people that were highly trained just snap, you know what I mean, and then regain their composure after a period of time. But I find it just real interesting, all this. Your book sounds very interesting because how definition changes over the years, too. But I just want to know if you know if there's any literature on that, the idea of normalcy, normal behavior. I mean, sort of John Paul Stevens said once, you know pornography when you see it. I guess I wondered, normal when you see it.
Right.
I don't know if that makes any sense to you. I'll take your answer out there. Thank you.
All right.
It does. Perfect sense. Two or three things you bring up. First, the idea of these historical diagnoses from the past. The history of medicine, and especially the history of the mental sciences, is full of these terms. And they often have a longer history than their present-day counterpart. So for millennia, medical observers talked about melancholy and melancholia before the term depression came to replace that, beginning in about the late 19th century. One historic diagnosis I'm fond of is neurasthenia. That was a late 19th century Gilded Age term, and I just think it's quite colorful and poetic, more so than the contemporary terms. Hysteria as an official diagnosis, as any mental health worker in your audience knows, was officially abandoned by the American Psychiatric Association about three decades ago. And its reformulation, it's been broken up into a number of different labels, but the most common is something like transient idiopathic somatization disorder,
mm-hmm.
Which obviously it's more scientific sounding, but doesn't fall trippingly off the tongue. So I joke with my students that I actually prefer the older diagnoses and would much rather be known as, a hysteric or a neurasthenic than borderline or whatever. On normal, yes, this is obviously the most fundamental question underpinning the study of this subject, and there has been an enormous amount of commentary of writing about it. You pose the question, what is normal? There's a book with that very title. I can't recall for you the editors, but if you were just to Google that title, what is normal, you would come up with the book, a collection of articles. The key point probably is that what constitutes normal and abnormal varies enormously from time to time, country to country, and culture to culture. Mm. So even if you were to travel within Europe, which is the part of the world I study professionally, from Ireland to England to France to the Mediterranean countries into Eastern Europe, you would basically find differing, lots of overlap, but also differing senses of what types of emotional behavior were healthy or unhealthy, perfectly normal or excessive. Mm. I think I'll leave it at that.
Yeah. One of the things that it really strikes me is that something that I think doctors have still are still really stumped by and are probably not much better able to deal with today than they ever have is the patient who comes in and says, "Doctor, I'm in pain. I hurt." So you examine them and you can't find any obvious organic cause.
Yes.
And I think that perhaps we have come to understand that that those people, when they tell you they're in pain, they are in pain, that they they're actually feeling pain. And so, you know, you can't minimize that in saying, ah, well, it's all in your head. You know, that's what we used to call, maybe still do call, psychosomatic illness.
Yes.
Well, it may all be in their head, but that doesn't mean they don't hurt. So, but it seems that we've changed the labels for those things, but we seems like we really don't quite, we're not much better at understanding what's going on now than we ever have been.
Right. I think the pain issue, again, is very relevant. If you look at the descriptions of hysteria 100 years ago during its so-called golden age, hysterical pain was often part of the clinical picture. Whereas in our own time, we have separated out that symptom and kind of elevated it into its own discrete diagnosis. So as you may or may not know, psychiatry today has formulated the concept of psychogenic pain disorder. And of course, we have whole clinics that specialize, you know, pain clinics that specialize in what appears to be non-organic pain. And as you say, these symptoms may not track to a known organic cause, but that may simply mean that we don't have the test, the investigative technique to determine its organic cause, or it may mean that there's a psychological component. But as you rightly point out, it took physicians generations to realize that that does not mean this is not a problem. You don't just say to the person, well, this is in your head, it's you're faking it. This is causing, the situation is causing a lot of subjective distress on the part of the patient. Mm-hmm. And we're still today grappling with how to respond in the best way to those cases. I've read that as many as a quarter of the visits a GP is likely to get in his or her practice may involve a component of this subjective distress. Mm-hmm. And so medicine clearly, you know, has to take that volume of cases seriously.
All right, let's talk with another caller, Effingham, next on our toll-free line, line four. Hello.
Yes, I have two questions. The first is, has your guest ever heard of Henry Louis Morgan, Branislaw Malinowski, Frederick Engels, or Wilhelm Reich? And the study of both psychiatry and psychology and the symptoms and the results of male domination.
Male domination?
Domination, the patriarch, the patriarchal societies that now dominate the human population on this earth, all 6-7 billion of us.
Yes, yes. Some of those names I'm familiar with, I guess above all Friedrich Engels and Wilhelm Reich.
Well, Wilhelm Reich, he, so far, and I'm reading it studiously, which the others I had heard of before, and their references to maternalism and the domination of society, not domination, but the nuancing of society under the auspices of women, which was early on. I mean, when males began to push their way to the front and to do away with the old matriarchs and take their power and establish it in their own right, which led to the problems we have today in psychiatry, you know, which the remnants of that go back very far. But the you cannot, in a social situation, have children raising children, which is what happens. And then when these people begin to mature physically and are immature psychologically and psychiatrically, then all the problems stem from there. And your reference to too much drinking or other sorts of mind-changing apparatus that people have access to, and then the fallout from that. I might add that I was raised in a nuclear family by a drunken father. And what I witnessed from the time I could understand anything was frightening. So do you have anything to say about these people that, you know, discovered the ancient or the remnants, I should say, of female society?
The part of your question that stands out to me is your emphasis on patriarchy. This is a term now that my colleagues, my professional colleagues in gender studies, are kind of backing away from because they think it has been overgeneralized in the scholarship of the past generation. But be that as it may, the underlying idea is certainly still invaluable. This is the link I'd make with my story. Throughout the research on my project, it was clear that the reason it was so difficult for male physicians to acknowledge a neurotic susceptibility in members of their own sex is basically because they were operating in what was, broadly speaking, a patriarchal system, a world in which men possessed the overwhelming majority of the power, at least in all of the public domains of the economy and business, politics, education, and women were much more limited to what they were able to do legally, educationally, and so forth. This, in patriarchal societies, the feminine comes to mean the weak, the fragile, the limited, the undesirable. And the masculine means what is powerful and desirable and rational. So patriarchies would generate a kind of medical phenomenon like I've studied. In order to sustain them, you have to continually deny the possibility that men may be as susceptible nervously as women are. I hope that makes sense, but that's the link I would make with patriarchy.
And I hope the caller will forgive me. I need to jump in. We just have about 10 minutes left, and I have some other folks I'd like to get into the conversation and also to introduce, for anyone who might have just tuned in the last 10 or 15 minutes, our guest, Mark McCauley. He is Associate Professor of History and History of Medicine at University of Illinois here in Urbana-Champaign. And again, if you'd like to read more on the subject we're discussing, you look for his book, Hysterical Men, The Hidden History of Male Nervous Illness, published by the Harvard University Press. We have next someone to talk with in Champaign. That would be line three. Hello.
Thank you. Yeah, three basic points. A few years ago, I read a really fascinating book on male depression entitled I Don't Want to Talk About It. And the author basically was saying that he believed that depression was more prevalent among men than women, but in part we don't realize that because men are trained to not even acknowledge the feelings to themselves, let alone to others, and so they didn't even recognize their depression. Another point would be that, you know, in part, mental illness is what we define it as, and, you know, we choose to define certain things as mental illness and other things not. You already kind of touched on that, but I would say that, you know, the idea that war is a legitimate way to resolve disputes is a type of mental illness, and maybe we, you know, could get some progress in the world if we would define it as such. And then finally, as someone who follows the literature, as Western science looks more and more into how the immune system works, how the endocrine system works, the feedback loops between all the various systems in the body, it's becoming harder and harder for Western science to make a distinction between the mind and the body. Might be better to think of it as the body-mind. And I don't know if that affects, you know, the way you look at things or not.
Mm-hmm. On depression, I gather from my medical friends that the study of severe depressive disorders in men is now one of the new hot-button issues in the field. It was either Time Magazine or Newsweek, what about a year ago, that actually ran a front-page story about greater levels of depression in the general population than we realized, and announced on the front page that it was, on the front cover, that it was men too that were part of this population. So I think that's a change that's going on in our own time. On your last point, you are absolutely right to say that a great number of people in the past who were diagnosed psychiatrically and maybe even committed to asylums and certainly treated by nerve doctors in the past, as they were called in Victorian times, had today, we would say, non-psychiatric organic diseases which had a psychological component. So if you were to go to, say, Bedlam Hospital in the famous in London in the 17th century, or even the hospital where Charcot studied in the late 19th century, and walk through the insanity ward, and could somehow magically give these patients blood tests and EKGs and EEGs and all the rest, endocrinological tests, you would find a significant number of them who might test positive for epilepsy, Parkinson's disease, Alzheimer's, syphilis perhaps in particular, because this was a period before the treatment of antibiotics, when syphilis was allowed to advance to the third and fourth stage where it got into the brain and then spinal cord. So diagnosing accurately and differentially psychiatric from other disorders has been a great challenge in the history of psychiatry. We think we've made great progress today, but who knows what discovery might be right around the corner. You know, maybe we will find that there's a virus or a bacteria that underlies what we call schizophrenia, and suddenly it will be treated then by a general practitioner rather than, you know, someone with a specialty in psychiatry.
We thank the last caller. Again, we'll go next to someone in Chicago, line one. Hello. Is there a caller there in, on line one in Chicago? Yeah, go ahead.
I was to make the comment personally that during the Second World War, when I was just a teenager out of high school, I was drafted into the Army, and after a brief evaluation of the possibly psychiatry, a psychologist, the classification was come up as indifferent. Well, when you consider the way the world has gone since then, and it certainly seems to be abnormal, you can call me anything you want to say, but don't call me normal. And I just wanted to point out that what with the changes in the world, we have an economic tsunami collapsing all standards of living and other resources changing and environmental circumstances changing. I just wonder how people are going to be reacting to these surmounting events and how psychiatry is going to respond to dealing with these potential breakdowns in relationships and behavior on a scale that we're seeing. Thank you.
Well, just briefly, I understand your exasperation at the label that was applied to you. The power of a diagnosis can be enormous in shaping how an individual thinks about themselves and their biography, their personality, their life situation, and so forth. And sometimes the diagnosis is very necessary, but other times it seems people play loose and fast with them, with those labels. If you've seen the film with Winona Ryder, Girl Interrupted, it's based on the novel by Susanna Kaysen. At one point, a patient learns that she's been diagnosed as borderline this and that with sociopathic elements, and she refers to it as her diagnonsense. So we can't live without diagnoses, but in the field of psychiatry, many people feel they've kind of gotten out of hand or are used indiscriminately. Your last point touches on a much larger phenomenon that people have asked for a good long time. It gets back to the earlier caller's idea of what's normal. In an insane world, what constitutes sanity? That's the idea, I think, behind the caller's observation. Mm. And it's quite legitimate. If the evening news is bursting out with forms of irrationality and we all have to make our way in that world, how do you then expect everyone to be a model of sanity?
Yeah. Well, one of the ways that you can read your book, Hysterical Men, is indeed about the hidden history of male nervous illness, but it also gives you something of the history of psychology, because it goes from the ancient world where people they were looking for some organic explanation for mental illness. They didn't understand what was going on, but at least they thought it was something in the body. From there, we went to demon possession.
Mm-hmm.
Then we got away from demon possession when we were getting back to trying to understand what was going on in the body, and they were actually starting to do dissections, and they were looking at the body. And they rejected the old explanation of hysteria because they were doing dissections of women, and they looked at their uteruses, and they said, well,
There's nothing going on here. Right. So they said this doesn't have anything to do with their uterus.
Yes.
So they were but then they were looking for a medical, at least they were trying to look for a medical explanation. And did that, you know, to the limits of what their science could do. Then we get to into the 19th century, and we got guys like Charcot and Freud, mm-hmm. who were also somewhat, you know, they were trying to take a scientific approach. There were some, limited, you know, they couldn't do brain scans. So they really concentrated, Freud particularly, really concentrated on people's experience.
Yes.
So from them we have this idea that traumatic experience can produce mental illness.
Right.
And that it may or may not have something to do with a predisposition that people have. Who knows what that is? But Charcot particularly said, well, you know, maybe there's something about a particular person that just makes them susceptible. Something happens and whammo, there we see the effect. So there, you know, and now we've come to a time when our understanding, at least we've got a better understanding of things like the chemistry of the brain.
Mm-hmm.
We can actually look inside the brain and see what's going on and try to get a better idea of the functioning. But it somehow seems that, I mean, truly there's an enormous gap between what we know and what we would like to know. And that there are still big questions about, yes, well, what's the effect of people's experience?
Mm-hmm.
And what's the effect of the kind of brain chemistry that people are born with? And how can experience alter the chemistry that people are born with? It's striking me that it's still like a vast unexplored territory, really.
Mm-hmm. Certainly the dominant model for understanding today what was formerly labeled hysteria would be a neurochemical, neurophysiological, mm-hmm. maybe also genetic model. This is probably what I found most fascinating about researching the book is the very dramatic evolution of theories over time. They are so completely different one from the other. Mm-hmm. And I particularly like learning about those periods when a sudden increase in medical knowledge disproved a prior belief system. So can you imagine that point? We think it actually took place during the late Roman period, but was then reinforced during the Renaissance, when autopsies were no longer deemed sacrilegious to cut open the divine body. And people began post-mortem to examine the female body and realized that the uterus, far from being enormous, the womb, was at least in its unpregnated state rather small, that it was connected, held in place through a series of ligaments, and that the body cavity was densely packed with other organs. So there was just no way that it could have, you know, sort of wandered through the female body system.
Mm-hmm.
But even then, again, this is an indication of how determined male doctors were to continue to see this as a female malady. They often would just reconfigure the type of explanation in the eyes of updated medical information. So once the theory of the literal wandering womb was squelched, many doctors quickly developed a follow-up theory, which was a chemical one. And according to this theory, the womb, while it remained fixed in place, produced all of these noxious, toxic chemicals and fumes that would waft upward through the body cavity of the woman and give rise to all of these hysterical, arch-feminine symptoms.
Mm.
So one way to read this entire history of hysteria is as a series of male attempts, often quite extravagant, to make sense of the opposite sex, which they clearly found to be mysterious and incomprehensible.
Yeah. We're just almost out of time. Another thing, though, I think is also very interesting is this: the fact that at certain points, people were willing to allow the fact that men could be of a nervous disposition, but not all men. This was something that refined men could experience. Upper middle and upper class men. Common men, working class men, no, they wouldn't.
Yes.
They wouldn't have this.
Right, exactly. Again, a strategy of resistance, a way of sort of acknowledging the latest clinical information, but still sort of insulating your own group from the negative connotations, the feminizing connotations of applying this old, ancient, gendered label to what was supposed to be the strong, powerful, and was the domineering sex at the time.
Yeah. Very interesting. Did you feel that you came away with it somehow with, you know, obviously you any scholar goes into a project with particular questions, things that really interest you or things that you want to know. Did you feel that you came out with a better understanding that you started?
Well, I'm glad at least that your last question wasn't how am I invested autobiographically in my topic.
I wouldn't be rude of me to ask you, so are you feeling hysterical?
I joke with friends and colleagues that given the book's title, Hysterical Men, that it's my autobiography. I did learn an enormous amount. I didn't even think this was a subject, you know, that existed at the beginning, at the outset. And I found out that not only is it a subject, but it's quite a fascinating subject, but complicated, convoluted. And what I've done with the book is try, I think for the first time, to piece it all together and make sense of it.
Yeah. Well, there we will leave it again with the mention that if you would like to read more on the subject, the book is Hysterical Men, The Hidden History of Male Nervous Illness. It's published by the Harvard University Press by our guest Mark Micali, and his last name spelled M-I-C-A-L-E. He is Associate Professor of History and History of Medicine here at University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. Thanks very much for being here.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 archives. Many of our past shows, along with interviews from the Afternoon Magazine and local news features, are available on our website anytime that you're ready to listen. Just go to will.illinois.edu. At this point, we'll take our usual break for news, and then Focus 580 will continue, so please stay tuned.